Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're looking at a case that really changed the game for renters in California, and frankly, across the country. The 1974 California Supreme Court decision in Green v. Superior Court.
Mm-hmm.
If you've ever signed a lease, this case is probably more relevant to you than you might think.
That's absolutely right. This wasn't just, you know, a routine legal squabble. It fundamentally redefined what landlords are responsible for providing.
Right.
And in turn, significantly bolstered the rights of tenants. Think of this as your insiders look at a pivotal moment in, well, the evolution of tenant protections, the establishment of the implied warranty of habitability.
Exactly. Our goal today is to sort of dissect this landmark ruling. Mm-hmm. We'll explore the specific set of unfortunate circumstances that brought this case before the highest court in California.
Yeah, quite unfortunate.
The critical legal questions they were wrestling with, the logic that underpinned their ultimately groundbreaking decision, and, well, why this ruling continues to be a cornerstone of landlord-tenant law today.
Mm.
Understanding Green v. Superior Court is like grasping a foundational principle in this area, so let's get into it.
Okay, let's start with the situation that sparked this whole thing. At the center of it were Roger Green, the tenant, and Jack Sumsky, his landlord. And this wasn't a case of, like, a minor repair issue.
No.
The conditions in Mr. Green's apartment were, by all accounts, appalling.
Appalling is putting it mildly. I mean, imagine a collapsed bathroom ceiling.
Wow.
Then factor in a significant rodent and insect problem. We're talking rats, mice, cockroaches, a real unwelcome menagerie. And to make matters worse, there was no heat in four rooms during presumably colder months, consistently black plumbing, unsafe electrical wiring.
Oh, dangerous.
That posed a genuine hazard and an illegally installed and unsafe stove. You just picture the state of disrepair.
Yeah, and it wasn't just anecdotal either. A formal inspection by the city's housing authority documented the severity, revealing an astonishing 80 separate housing code violations.
80.
80. The situation was so dire that a hearing to condemn the property was actually scheduled.
80 violations.
Yeah.
That really underscores the severity. So facing these truly unacceptable living conditions, Mr. Green understandably decided to, well, withhold his rent.
Right.
That's when his landlord, Mr. Sumsky, took him to small claims court. Unfortunately for Mr. Green, the initial ruling didn't go his way. He was ordered to pay the back rent and to vacate the premises.
Which must have felt like a real injustice, you know? He was living in what sounds like uninhabitable conditions, yet he was being told he still owed rent and had to leave.
Exactly.
But this is where the story takes a crucial turn. Mr. Green appealed this decision to the Superior Court. And here's where things get particularly interesting, because the landlord's main argument was that the state of the property, regardless of how bad it was, legally couldn't be used as a reason to not pay rent in an eviction case.
Right. Mr. Sumsky's legal team essentially argued that Mr. Green's only legal recourse, the sole option available to him under California law at the time, was something called repair and deduct, which was outlined in California Civil Code sections 1941 and 1942. These statutes allowed a tenant to make, you know, minor repairs up to a certain amount and then deduct those costs from their rent.
Yeah, but there were limits, right?
Exactly. There were limitations on what could be repaired and how much could be deducted. And tenants had to follow specific procedures.
Mm.
And interestingly, the Superior Court actually agreed with the landlord's interpretation.
They did. The Superior Court's ruling essentially said, yeah, the conditions might be bad, but your only legal avenue, Mr. Green, is to fix it yourself within the statute's limits and deduct it.
Which sounds completely inadequate for 80 violations.
Totally inadequate. And this is where the, you know, the fundamental inadequacy of the existing law became apparent. And that's why the California Supreme Court ultimately decided to hear the case. They recognized that a much broader legal principle was at stake. The very question of whether an implied warranty of habitability should even exist under California law.
Ah, okay.
The limited scope and, frankly, the practical difficulties of repair and deduct in a situation like that. With 80 violations, that likely played a big role in the Supreme Court deciding to take it.
Okay, so that gives us a clear picture of this situation. Now, let's focus on what the California Supreme Court was specifically asked to decide. What were the key legal questions they were trying to answer?
Well, there were two primary legal questions that the Supreme Court really grappled with. The first and most fundamental was, does California law recognize an implied warranty of habitability in residential leases?
Okay.
Basically, is there an unwritten, legally binding promise by the landlord to provide and maintain a safe and livable place for the whole lease, you know, regardless of what the paper actually says?
That would be a big shift.
A huge shift from the traditional view of a lease as just like a property rights transfer.
And what was the second crucial question?
The second, an equally critical question, was whether a tenant could use the landlord's breach of this warranty, assuming the court recognized it as a valid legal defense in an eviction case.
So could Green say, you can't evict me for not paying rent because you didn't give me a livable place?
Exactly. In simple terms, yeah. Could a tenant like Mr. Green argue that in court? These two questions are really intertwined and go right to the heart of the power dynamic in landlord-tenant relationships.
Absolutely. These questions really get to the core of fairness and, you know, the obligations that come with providing housing. So how did the California Supreme Court approach these fundamental issues? What was their reasoning behind this landmark decision?
Well, their reasoning represented a really significant shift from long-standing legal precedent. Traditionally, under common law, the view was that a lease was essentially a conveyance of land interest. Once the landlord handed over the keys, their legal duties pretty much ended. No ongoing duty to keep it habitable. It was kind of the tenant's problem after that.
That does sound quite out of step with modern urban life. Maybe that worked for, like, farmland leases.
Right, where the tenant managed the land.
But in a city apartment, it's a totally different situation.
Precisely. And the court explicitly acknowledged this fundamental change. They emphasized that in, you know, modern urban settings, tenants usually lack both the expertise and, crucially, the money to make big repairs.
Makes sense.
Think about it, expecting a tenant to fix a collapsed ceiling or major plumbing, it's just not realistic for most renters.
It's certainly not. And like in Mr. Green's case, you can have huge systemic issues affecting the whole building. No single tenant could fix that.
Exactly. And this brings us to another critical part of the court's thinking. The socioeconomic context. California's housing situation at the time, the justices saw that with a major shortage of affordable housing, tenants often had very limited options. They couldn't just pick up and move if their place fell apart.
They were basically tracked.
Pretty much. This lack of real choice really highlighted the need for stronger legal protections for tenants.
That makes complete sense. If tenants don't have viable alternatives, they're really vulnerable to landlords who might not, you know, feel incentivized to keep things up.
Exactly. And this is where the court introduced the pivotal concept of mutual dependency.
Okay.
They reasoned that a tenant's obligation to pay rent is inherently dependent on the landlord's obligation to provide and maintain a habitable living space. It's like a contract where both sides' promises are linked.
One relies on the other.
Right. As the court famously stated, and this is a crucial point, tenants don't owe rent if the property isn't livable.
Wow.
This was a radical departure from the old view where you just paid rent no matter what.
That's a really powerful statement. It captures the whole shift. So let's go back to those repair and deduct laws the landlord brought up. How did the Supreme Court fit their ruling in with those existing statutes?
Good question. The court clarified that while those statutory remedies, the repair and deduct options, did exist, they weren't meant by the legislature to be the only remedies for tenants in unlivable conditions.
Oh, okay.
The Supreme Court said the implied warranty of habitability provided an additional, more fundamental layer of protection rooted in common law. And this implied warranty could be used by tenants, including as a direct defense against eviction.
So it didn't replace repair and deduct?
No, repair and deduct remained an option, but it wasn't the only one. And importantly, it didn't cancel out the tenant's basic right to a livable place. The court probably saw that repair and deduct just wasn't practical for severe issues, the cost limits needing tenants to pay up front.
Right. With 80 violations, you're not just fixing a leaky faucet.
Exactly. The implied warranty offered a more fundamental right and, frankly, a more powerful legal tool for tenants like Mr. Green.
Okay. So now let's consider what happens when a landlord is found to have breached this implied warranty. How are damages, or I guess the rent reduction, calculated?
Right. This is where the specifics matter. The court explained that if a landlord violates the warranty, the tenant's rent can be reduced. But it's not necessarily like zero rent.
Yeah.
Instead, the reduction should be proportionate to how much the property's habitability has been diminished by the problem.
So it's like a percentage thing.
Kind of. Think of it this way. If major issues like no heat in winter or that collapsed ceiling make a big chunk of the place unusable or unsafe, say, the court thinks it reduces the value by 30%.
Then the rent might be cut by 30%.
Potentially, yes. A corresponding reduction might be appropriate. The assessment is based on how much the landlord failed to provide a suitable living environment, affecting the value for the tenant.
That sounds like a reasonable approach. It stops tenants from just withholding all rent for minor stuff.
Exactly. And the court was clear on that. minor or trivial defects, a loose doorknob, slightly chipped paint, generally wouldn't be enough to justify withholding rent or getting a big reduction.
It has to be serious.
Yes, the problems must be serious enough to affect health, safety, and overall habitability, what the court called the bare living requirements.
Right, it's about fundamental living standards, not just, you know, aesthetics.
Absolutely. And to address concerns about tenants maybe unfairly using this new defense.
Yeah, potential abuse.
The court also acknowledged the need for procedural safeguards. They suggested things like maybe requiring tenants to put the disputed rent into an escrow account while the case is ongoing.
Like putting the money aside?
Right, or demanding clear evidence of the violations. These ideas were meant to ensure fairness and stop the warranty from being misused.
That makes sense. You need some checks and balances. So taking a broader view now, why is Green v. Superior Court considered such a landmark case? Why is it still so important today?
Well, Green v. Superior Court had a truly profound impact. California's decision acted as a major catalyst, influencing courts and legislatures in many other states.
Really? It spread?
Oh, yeah. Many jurisdictions followed California's lead, adopting similar implied warranties. It led to a nationwide strengthening of tenant rights and really shifted how landlord-tenant law is understood.
So this one case in California set a legal precedent that echoed across the country.
In many significant ways, yes. It fundamentally changed the legal landscape, making things more equitable. But its significance goes beyond just legal precedent, too. You can look at it through the lens of, like, consumer protection.
How so?
Well, the court essentially recognized that a lease isn't just about land, it's about buying the right to a safe, habitable home.
Like buying a product.
Exactly. And just like consumers of anything else, tenants have a right to expect a certain level of quality and safety. As the court implied, you could say, leases are like products tenants deserve a livable good.
That's a really insightful analogy. It reframes the whole relationship.
Precisely. And ultimately, Green fundamentally addressed the often huge power imbalance between landlords and tenants, especially in tight housing markets like California's.
It gave tenants a tool.
A crucial legal tool, yeah, to ensure basic standards of health and safety. And it gave landlords a real incentive to keep their properties maintained.
So to bring it all together, what is the core message, the essential takeaway from our deep dive into Green v. Superior Court?
The central enduring takeaway is this. Green v. Superior Court firmly established the implied warranty of habitability in California law. This means landlords have a legal obligation to keep residential properties livable.
And tenants.
And tenants have a vital legal defense against eviction if their landlords fail that basic responsibility. It was truly a transformative decision that significantly empowered tenants.
And when we consider, you know, the complexities of the housing landscape today, it's clear this landmark ruling continues to shape the fundamental rights and responsibilities on both sides.
Yeah.
It really set a baseline standard for safe and healthy living that we often take for granted now.
Absolutely.
But it was a hard-won right, secured through this incredibly significant legal battle. Definitely something to keep in mind. Thanks for joining me for this deep dive.